Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 132, The Psychology of Doll Work, January 13, 2007. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
I began, as I mentioned, making dolls. And so I made both porcelain dolls and fabric dolls and cloth dolls, contemporary dolls. And I kept hearing stories from people about how the doll making process was healing for them. And there might have been a mother with a son who had died from cancer, and so she made a doll with all the tubes from his IVs. And other people would make dolls that represented children that had not been born or had been born ill. And I just kept hearing them. And then I noticed in my own experience and the experience of others making dolls with me, that we just felt better.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Jerry Olson. Jerry Olson, PhD, is associate professor in the psychology department at Sonoma State University, where she'll soon assume the role of department chair. Jerry teaches and leads workshops in the area of creativity and expressive arts. Jerry points out that dolls have been a part of human existence for 25,000 years. From fertility rituals to child's play, dolls have a central role in portraying the story and values of a culture. The power of the doll is expanded as we move back in time and explore dolls with a cross-cultural perspective. In that search, the importance of dolls in healing, rites of passage, and empowerment become evident. This understanding of the historical and psychological role of dolls has created a revisioning of the influence of the doll. Dolls are often used in sand tray work, hospital programs, and in educational programs for abusive parents, but very little is written about the deeply evocative experience of making a doll. What power does the doll that we create have in revealing the images and narrative of a person's inner life? How could the doll capture and reflect a glimpse of the psyche? In Jerry's work with students and therapists, dolls are created as mirrors of the self, as figures in a personal myth, and as allies, elders, healers, and guides on the path to authenticity and health. The doll narrates a deeply personal story from an adventure to the interior. Jerry has integrated the doll process into her work for 25 years and is the coordinator of a doll project that has included over 600 K-12 students. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Jerry Olson, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure for me to be here, and I'm with you in your house, and this is the first time I've been here, and it's a lovely house in Petaluma, which for our listeners is kind of what used to be a very rural town, and it's turning into a kind of very trendy.
Oh, we have a movie theater and, you know.
Yeah, and a trendy little
Starbucks.
Yeah, a trendy artsy kind of town, which is an appropriate place for you to live. I should let our listeners know that you and I have been longtime friends and colleagues. And when I first met you, you were a graduate student here working on your master's degree. And then you went off and you earned a PhD and had many adventures in the world, and eventually returning to Sonoma State. And now you've just been elected department chair starting next year. So it's been quite a rise.
Yes, and people are giving me both their condolences and their congratulations.
And they're probably both well-deserved. Well, you've always been one of the most creative people that I've ever known. And you've always been involved in a variety of crafts, making things with your hands. Like, I remember for many years you were a quilt maker, and you made all sorts of quilts and went to quilt shows. And in more recent years, dolls have
seem to have supplanted quilts and become very important in your work. How did that transition to doll making happen?
Well, that is really a great question because I never really grew up playing with very many dolls. I was too old when Barbie was invented and had some traditional rag dolls and so forth. But I made my first doll when I first was a student at Sonoma State, and I was made a rag doll for a friend who had a baby. She was very young, you know, a freshman or so at Sonoma State. And that really was my more contemporary or modern way of working with dolls. And while I was doing that, I found that it was a wonderful experience. But if I could go back just a little bit, I actually made dolls at one point in junior high. I had a friend, sort of a boyfriend, that was sent away to a military school, they called it, but it was really more for truancy and things like that, yeah. I'm afraid. And I would make these dolls with poems and messages on it, and I'm sure this person was mortified when they'd come in the mail. You know, you can imagine a teenage boy getting, these dolls. And then when my mother was a lecturer, one of the very first Weight Watcher lecturers, I would make these little figures that held signs that said, "You can do it," and "I'm a winner." And she sold them for a dollar to Weight Watchers. And the local newspaper did an article on me, and I was probably around maybe 15 at the time. But again, that stopped when I went to college, and it wasn't until I began to do expressive arts at Sonoma State that I found the doll a wonderful medium.
Expressive arts, that's a great term that maybe we should talk about a little bit, because I don't think it's a term I've used much or have interviewed. Let's see, I did interview Suzanne Lovell, so it might have come up then. But say a little bit about expressive arts and what that term means to you.
Right. Well, I think most people are familiar with art therapy, which, of course, is the use of art to explore inner dynamics and so forth. But expressive arts includes all of the arts, so music, poetry, dance, and many different forms of art, not just two-dimensional, but three-dimensional, such as doll making. And you can now really study expressive arts at several universities, where you're looking at all of the ways that art can be used in understanding the self and in growing personally, or as a teacher or an educator or a therapist, clinician, so forth. You could integrate the arts into your practice.
Yeah. Yes. And in fact, there are master's degree programs, right, in expressive arts.
Yes.
And in our own area, we have Natalie Rogers, the daughter of Carl Rogers, and she's really built a whole program around expressive arts, and I keep meaning to interview her, and I haven't gotten around to her yet.
And that would be so valuable, because really I think she's credited frequently with launching expressive arts as a clinical, intervention. And there are others, for example, Anna Halpern, who has had a dance therapy institute, Tamalpa Institute in Marin County. And there are individuals who have now been around for a very long time, but they together comprise the expressive arts movement.
Yes. Well, most people don't think of psychology or personal growth in relation to dolls. But you see a strong connection. So take us through that.
Okay. So one of the interests of mine began really with the history of dolls and the kind of psychological history of dolls. When I began to look back in time and study different cultures, I saw that there were figures often. There were many different kinds of figures. And sometimes we would call them statues. But as I read more, I saw that they were really dolls for adults. Mm-hmm. And examples of this would be in cultures where fertility was a very serious issue. And dolls would be either strapped to a woman, or she'd hold them in her pocket, or shamans would carve special dolls. And that this attachment to the doll was really to bring about this mind-body relationship where you were always conscious of fertility. You might be using the doll to announce to others that you were ready to have a mate and to start a family. And this interested me.
Interesting. Yeah, it is interesting.
It was so interesting to me. And then there are...
Because, I just want to note in passing that it's interesting to me how this passion of yours has made you have to become kind of an art historian, an anthropologist, an artist.
I go to museums far more now than I go to fabric stores, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, in other words, for the materials to construct figures, I'm often going to museums around the country and looking at the collections, Native American collections and ancient Greek collections of figures, and seeing where they're mentioned as actually being a doll. So one of the exhibits that inspired me was in 1995 at the Valor Museum in UCLA. There was a wonderful exhibit called Isn't She/He a Doll? And they collected figures from all over Africa and plastic dolls that, you know, we would consider just at the dollar store, you know, something very simple, all the way to these ancient fertility figures. And they used them all to represent the doll and asked the question. And these were historians and curators and sociologists and so forth. And they asked that question, isn't this really a doll? Because a doll is any human representation or somewhat human representation in a figure that's used by a person, that's interacted with a person. So a sculpture would be something maybe on a shelf, but anytime there's interaction. And so they traced many rituals to these figures that made them seem like both through childhood all the way through adulthood, these were really dolls, and they could be called dolls. The problem is in our culture, the word doll is very, you know...
It's very circumscribed and very narrow. It's a toy that little girls have, and that's all it is, right? Except it's expanded now to boys have these action figures.
Oh, absolutely.
But we don't call them dolls.
No.
Do we?
But actually, for a time, they were imported as dolls. And some of the bigger companies, I believe it was Hasbro and possibly Mattel, tried to change that. But they're actually technically were for a long time imported as dolls because of the various fees and so forth that were connected to them. But back to what we were talking about, it's interesting for the West, and considering that we're in the West, this idea that the real world and the play world are really sharply divided is different from many earlier cultures where the real world and the play world were more intimately connected.
Yeah, the world of imagination.
Right. And so people could go into their imaginal world and bring that imaginal world to the real world in conversation and through their art and so forth. And many times art, including music and dance and sculpting dolls or carving, you know, figures of different kinds, were ways to tell the history of that inner world and to keep it alive. And so many times we think that some of these figures, which look very crude to us, many of them, now, were really a way to say, this is how I see my inner world.
And their very crudeness, though, really has inspired what we call abstract art, hasn't it, in many cases?
Yes. Actually, there have been artists that have gone to study what we now call, quote, primitive art, although there are many other words attached to it now. But they wanted to be in the presence of early art, early cultures, and even Picasso studied children's art.
And to be in that presence maybe is to be in the presence of early forms of consciousness where there was less of that dividing line that you were talking about.
And I think surrealism has some connections to that, even more than modern abstract art, and because that is surrealism is so celebrating the unconscious.
Yes. Well, speaking of the unconscious, I'm thinking about Carl Jung and his work and his impact and the style of depth work, you know, which I know that you are very familiar with and versed in. And so I'm thinking of it as exemplified in dream work. You and I were in a dream group together for many years. From back in those days when you were a master's student and I was a new faculty person, and we were in a dream group for a year or so. It had a big impact on me and my subsequent interest. So there's dream work, there's sand tray or sand play work. Mm-hmm. How do dolls fit into that?
Well, I can tell you how it fits into my work now. I began, as I mentioned, making dolls. And so I made both porcelain dolls and fabric dolls and cloth dolls, contemporary dolls. And I kept hearing stories from people about how the doll making process was healing for them. And there might have been a mother with a son who had died from cancer, and so she made a doll with all the tubes from his IVs. And other people would make dolls that represented children that had not been born or had been born ill. And I just kept hearing them. And then I noticed in my own experience and the experience of others making dolls with me that we just felt better being creative.
Yes.
And so as I noticed the collections of these stories would come out in various articles or brief documentaries that were made on creativity, I thought it would be good to integrate this into one of my classes. I found a sneaky way to do it. So I teach a class that you taught for many years and mentored me about this class, and it's called Myths, Dreams, and Symbols.
Sure.
And the class, in part, looks at your dream life, and we have dream groups in the class. In part, you explore the work of Carl Jung and the importance of the unconscious and being in touch with your inner life. But also, I use quite a bit of art in that class. So we have what I call a visual journal. So as you're working on your dreams, there's also a requirement that some of the pages be artistic or have collage.
Interesting.
So the visual journal, or what I also call the illuminated journal, is a balance between writing and really thinking about your dream, but also exploring that dream through art, or various dreams through art. And then as we study myths, we begin to write our own personal myth during the course of the class. And people take one figure from that myth and make the figure as their final project or part of their final. So
for example, what would be an example of somebody doing that?
Well, if someone was writing, we start out by doing some memoir and autobiographical work, and then we take that work and transfer that into mythic language so that a bad parent, say, or you know, someone who's hurt you sometime in your life, could be some sort of evil person, but also someone who's been wonderful in your life might become a jester. Others would become a warrior, or the author could become a warrior. And everyone takes several steps past reality to make it a mythic tale.
What an interesting approach. You always have such creative approaches to teaching. You say that you borrowed from me. No, I borrowed from you, and I need to borrow some more from you.
Well, the nice thing is to be able to borrow back and forth. That's a wonderful part of all of this work. And then when they take one of the figures, it could be an ally, or it could be someone wicked, or it could be a messenger of some sort. Mm-hmm. So this year, sometime one person made an owl that had many roles in her myth, but came to her at times of critical need. It really represented her intuition and her inner voice and the part of her that was wise in the midst of turmoil.
Wow.
And others would make ancient wise elders that represented grandmothers and others who they lost during the course of their life, but that they kind of hold very dear. And then there are some who will do themselves as heroic figures, you know, real warriors. And
some, you know, I've seen some of the dolls over the years. Yeah. For example, when I was department chair, as part of my sort of evaluative role, you invited me to come and visit a class that you were teaching at a local high school where they actually have a very strong arts program, and you were working with their arts students.
Yes.
And I saw the dolls that that they had created, and I wish this were a more visual experience here so that I could share it with our listening audience. I just have to say I was blown away by the the variety and the intensity that came through these projects. And many times the dolls carry a lot of pain.
Yes, they do. That was the ArtQuest program in Santa Rosa, fabulous art high school. And they had a project for three semesters in which I worked with their high school students. Each year they have their own internal theme, and so we would work it into the theme. And one year after 9/11, the spring after 9/11, we worked on figures that represented the child of our time. In other words, what is part of the experience of growing in these years that people are growing up? And people had to represent both the pain and the possibilities that are a part of this, that those years. And they often had in them, or they were asked to have in them, something they would carry with them somewhere that would enable them to go forward.
That must be the year I saw it, because I remember there were pouches or boxes inside.
Sometimes the head would open with a zipper, and they all started with the same 18-inch cloth doll, but they were allowed to take them apart and restitch them, and we worked with polymer clay, and they sculpted heads and hands, and they were fantastic.
Yeah, that's right. You gave them a kind of a blank, just a muslin, white cloth, blank, stuffed figure.
Yes.
And then the things that they did, it was very hard to recognize that original template
Absolutely.
That they began with.
And there were, for example, there was one year, and so each semester there was a different theme, but one semester.
And I have to say, many of these were museum quality. I would have paid money to buy them.
Extraordinary. Some of them got so huge, they were no longer 18 inches. They were much larger, and because they would sculpt large heads and then heads and then masks that went over the heads. And very interesting. Well, there was a doll. They could be disturbing if you looked at them and didn't know the stories behind them.
Yes.
But along with that, we did writing. They did poetry, and they did what's called a dialogue, so a dialogue with the doll. A process that we use often in our department. Ira Progoff made it very popular in the 70s, 80s, and so forth. And so there was a doll in a straitjacket, and it had a patient number on it. It was really striking. And so the doll was named Rita Lynn. And if you could see the poetry that the student wrote, the first line, the first letter of each line reading down says riddling, strangling me alive.
So it's Rita Lynn, which is really Ritalin,
Ritalin.
That they give to hyperactive kids.
Yes.
So that's a clever little play on words
and
there.
This is a very beautiful, healthy student who was going to had made a wonderful place for herself in the high school, but needed to move. The family was moving away. So I'll just read a few lines, if that's okay, of this poem. And it starts out remembering that the first letter reading down says Ritalin. So she says, ready for the day to break free. But for now, I'm trapped in this terrible contraption, waiting to come alive and show my true self, the lively, exciting girl that I really am. I hate being noticed as the quiet girl in the corner, sitting by herself. And so forth. And then in the end, she says, and now I'm going away where I'll have to meet new people, where I'll never get any ease and live the life I hate all over again, where I'll become vigilant and silent. This is a eulogy about Ritalin. And so this was a doll process that allowed this very healthy person, high school girl, to go back and reflect on a time that was difficult and to portray it through the doll and to also tell this story to her classmates about a part of her life that probably wasn't shared with most of them.
It's a very intimate story. And the kind of thing that that someone might feel some shame about, but somehow through the process of trust building and community building that I know that you created, and then expressing through art, through the doll.
Yes. Well, I think the important thing in this doll is the outer part was a straitjacket, but when you open the straitjacket, remembering that each student was to think of what they carry with them to their strength and to their process of growing. Inside was beautiful appliqué hearts and flowers all over the front of this doll. And it really represented that the spirit was stronger than the wounds, and that's what really carries a child of our time forward. And it was really a beautiful example. Other dolls would have, say, zippers and parts of the doll, either the heart or the head and other areas. And inside would be things that had been rocky for them. They would be representations of difficulties, and yet the doll itself would be very powerfully done.
Yeah. Well, I know that you don't work explicitly as a psychotherapist, although I believe that the teaching that you do is therapeutic. Mm-hmm. Are you aware of any therapists who are incorporating this sort of doll work, doll making into their therapy?
Yes, and there are many art therapists, because the class that I do in Mendocino each year, which is done somewhat as a retreat, attracts people who need CEUs and so forth, so it's open.
Continuing education units.
Right. And then art therapists come, and social workers come, and parents come, and artists come, and it's a wonderful collection of sharing ideas of how to utilize doll work in whatever work you're doing, teaching or clinical work. And there are several art therapists in the area who continue to have doll making supplies as part of their whole repertoire of materials available mm-hmm. to their clients. Mm-hmm. So they may do sand tray, but then they may have other ways of working with art, and doll making supplies are part of it.
And sometimes I think you mentioned that dolls are used as part of sand tray work, that I guess if a person makes a little doll, they could put it into the sand experience?
They could. Well, of course, with sand tray, there are hundreds of figures available for clients to use in the sand tray work. But sometimes people will have something they've made themselves, and occasionally that'll be integrated into that work, although traditional sand tray work would probably not encourage that.
Okay.
But it just depends on who's working.
I'm actually going to be interviewing a Jungian analyst who uses sand tray and who lives in Petaluma as well.
Yes.
You probably know her. Her name is Liza Ravitz. Do you know her?
Yes, I've heard her speak, and this will be a wonderful interview.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear it, because I've never met her, but one of my listeners asked for something on sand play, and you'll be interested in this. This listener is I think high school teacher, although I'm not certain about that. She teaches art in the UK and uses a form of sand play as part of that for stimulating and awakening student creativity.
Yes.
And so it was interesting to hear from that listener, and I know she'll be thrilled. I hope you're listening.
Yes, me
she'll
too.
Be thrilled by this interview and the one that's going to come up with Liza. And so you mentioned this workshop in Mendocino, just in case anybody can attend. I want to give a little bit more information about that. First of all, Mendocino is this magical artist town on the coast of Northern California. Absolutely beautiful, picturesque. Movie companies go there to shoot movies that are intended to look like New England often. Mm-hmm. And there's an art institute there with lots of classes and so on. So if someone wanted to attend one of your workshops that you teach there, what time of year does it happen? How would they get information about it?
Well, for probably 10 years, it's been in November, but this year it's in March. It's coming up March 1st and 2nd, Saturday and Sunday. And the best way to find out about it is to contact the Office of Extended Education at Sonoma State, although I'd be happy to send a flyer if someone wants to email me, and I believe that information could be on your...
You're okay with me putting your email address on our website. Okay,
yes.
That's good.
And on... One other thing that I'd like to mention is that I do work with teachers quite a bit, mm-hmm. and we do a project called the Doll Project in area schools, where we integrate art into the curriculum. We've done, and students from Sonoma State come to these schools and help me facilitate this project, and it's important to me that it's part of the curriculum because I want art to remain in the curriculum.
Yes.
And many of you know in California that's increasingly more difficult. And we've done about 700 dolls in the schools now. So the high school project is only a small part, actually, of this greater project. It's only dolls because it's become dolls. And many forms of art would be make me thrilled, would make my heart sing if teachers could use as much art as possible. But teachers have found in kindergarten through fifth grade and then plus high school that this doll project is also helping with retaining information. And if I could give one brief example, the last 3 years, one of the area elementary schools has chosen to use African American Month as the time when we do this project. And so the children read a book on African Americans, and after our first year, they got a wonderful grant that allowed them to buy many books on wonderful African Americans. So everyone wasn't doing, you know, Barry Bonds.
Yeah.
But they study the second graders. They study this character. They read a book. They draw pictures. And then I come in with very small blank dolls. This is about a 5-inch version of that larger blank doll. And the students, through a service learning project at Sonoma State, help them create that character. And so if someone was doing Martin Luther King or, you know, many numerous characters that they could choose and read about, then they make that character and then they write a report about it. So it's a literacy project, it's a history project, it's language arts and so forth. And many teachers have wonderful stories about second language learners being able to complete projects and about the aliveness that happens with the subject matter. And also, years later, I will sometimes run into these children in town, and they'll say, I still have my doll.
That's know? Great.
And so, and this will be the 9th year at one of the schools. I keep thinking as teachers retire that maybe I can move on to other schools, but it's, teachers insist that we return because it's a wonderful part of the curriculum.
Yeah. Well, you've done it from kindergarten, you know, all the way up through adult. And I'm aware that even people on the staff at the university and even, I think, the occasional administrator.
Yes.
Right, our dean, I believe. Didn't our dean sit in on your workshop, take a workshop?
She hasn't taken the workshop, but she's seen my presentation, the slide presentation on the history of dolls. And I've also looked at dolls that have been made by more eccentric artists and sometimes disturbed people. So the range of my interests is really grown.
Yeah.
It continues to grow. Yeah. So, yes, she's seen the presentation several times.
I wish that everyone could see your presentation. I've seen a slide presentation that you've given, and it definitely expanded my whole notion of dolls. You know, something that we haven't spoken about, we sort of briefly touched on little girly dolls and G.I. Joes and He-Man and what's the Hulk?
Yes.
The dolls like that. There is this chain of department stores in the U.S. called the American Girl.
Yes.
And I wandered into it quite by mistake. I was in Chicago for a market research project years ago, and I saw this big department store, and it was called the American Girl. And so I thought, well, I'll just go in here and see what this is about. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can talk about that a little bit.
Yes. You know, when we talk about just childhood dolls, there's – we know that a doll can be both a friend and an ally and a gateway to the imagination, a way to pretend to be older, a way to interact with others. And in addition, dolls really allow for these deep feelings of being in charge of your world.
Mm.
The American Girl doll, I believe it was started by Pleasant Company, is aimed at the slightly older girl who also wants to learn history but not leave her childhood dolls behind. Mm.
So when we say slightly older, what's the age range?
I believe that 8 to 10. Okay. In other words, many girls will pack away their young baby dolls and their childhood dolls and then their Barbie dolls, and they're still willing to be in this imaginal world in which they are organizing their relationships through this kind of play. And so the American Girl doll has a number of books on the history that that doll represents. So, for example, there's a Native American doll, and there'll be books associated with that doll that tell the story of that character as she lived her life. There's a Hispanic version. There's a Victorian girl, American Girl doll, and
Pioneer
Girl, an immigrant.
And they have clothing ensembles, right?
Yes.
So that the little girl can have the same clothing that her doll has.
Yes.
And I'm not sure. I think maybe the mother can even have the same clothing.
Yes. It's in also, so you can, yes, dress like your doll, but you also converse with your friends about the history. And so it was an attempt to really bring another dimension into doll making. Mm-hmm. Doll play. That, allowed us, like I said, a slightly older girl to still be in that relationship with her imagination.
Yeah.
And I think it's
so
wonderful.
You say it's wonderful. Yeah, I was going to say, is it a positive thing? I mean, you can see it in different ways. You can see it as the worst of American consumerist culture.
Absolutely.
Or...
Well, one problem we have with everything, whether it's technology or buying dolls or buying Nintendos or whatever the current PlayStation is that there is that opportunity to really buy a lot. Mm-hmm. The most primitive dolls, of course, were simple. And even in pioneer days and when in the frontier and even in small cities, dolls were either very simple, made by mom or grandmother or the child themselves, or they were imported from Europe. And so there was a more simplicity about it. So I think one of the qualities of the world we live in today is you can get quite excessive. And yes, one side of this is that it's now been bought by another company and that you could spend hundreds and hundreds of dollars on these dolls and clothes and so forth. But it's not unhealthy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not an unhealthy obsession, really. I'm not promoting this doll or whether you spend a lot of money, but this particular doll, I've seen children in grocery stores and around carrying this doll, and they really are free to be imaginative and playful and to remain children, which is, I think, a wonderful opportunity. You know, just to not have to be always studying and passing tests and all of that. So,
yeah, good point.
That quality, I think, is good. I do know the price has gone up substantially over the years, and you know, it's everything.
You know, one of the things that's striking to me is the woman who invented the Barbie doll, which is like very that doll has had just enormous success, right?
Yes.
And the Barbie doll has kind of sort of typified the idealized, can't think of the right word, Aryan white bread kind of girl. It was a Jewish woman, right?
Yes.
And so she really invented this doll that was very unlike her own identity.
Yes, but she did extensive research. Very bright woman. Did extensive research. And there were dolls in Europe at the time that were slightly more erotic or sexual in nature, but very appealing to the population where they were. And there was quite a bit of marketing and research that went into this doll. And I don't think that it was... immediately accepted, but she sold the idea, and it turned out to be a really good idea. A good idea from the marketing standpoint. I think there's quite a bit of controversy, of course, about Barbie, and books have been written about this. One problem is that it was the doll that made children sort of, or the controversy is that this doll would be the one that would make children feel like they had to be like Barbie.
Mm-hmm.
We just don't give children enough credit to be in that imaginal world and then to grow up to be wonderful, imaginative people. And so to place the responsibility on one doll for really shaping a child's whole concept of femininity is just one point of view. Another point of view is that if you have many models in your in the girl's life in which that's only one, but you have bright, successful mothers and you have traveling grandmothers and, you know, and an academic life that's alive and well, that playing with a Barbie is not likely to damage a child. But this is just my perspective.
Yeah, well, it's a very interesting perspective.
So I think you have to look at the doll in a broader context. And as a ritual of a way, as a childhood ritual of inviting play into your life, and it's monitored in the same way that television viewing is monitored or video game playing is monitored, then I think a parent could relax about a child playing with Barbie. And Barbie's changed over the years. Barbie got a job. You know, Barbie got
Barbie reflects what's going on in the culture.
Over the decades, every decade, Barbie has more jobs that she's done, and she's an astronaut and a school teacher, and you can buy all kinds of Barbies. You can buy Barbie of different ethnic backgrounds and her friends and so forth. And so and there's a new version of a Barbie-like doll in the Middle East, but there's no Ken. So there's a Barbie who does not have a boyfriend and a Barbie that does not do all the things that Barbie, the American Barbie, does right. and is allowed to do. And so that's very interesting because now you would see a culture, other cultures, shaping their dolls to reflect the values and morals of their
that culture. Sure.
Yes.
And Barbie also was used as for political protests, right? And so haven't there been feminist projects that have altered Barbie in strange ways?
Yeah, there have been, where you can take Barbie and represent your own personal story through the Barbie. And sometimes the Barbies are taken apart and reconstructed and they're altered Barbies. And so there have been projects like that. So Barbie has captivated the imagination of feminists as well as those who just really see nothing wrong with Barbie.
Yeah. So you've really expanded our view of the doll as a figure, and it can represent a projection of one's inner world. Mm-hmm. It can be as you point out, it's an invitation to enter the imaginal world and to build bridges to the imaginal world. It can be part of a healing process.
Yes.
It can be a cultural expression. It can be part of religious rituals, or I'm thinking voodoo dolls, for example.
Yes.
We haven't discussed voodoo dolls.
Well, the voodoo doll was actually a construction of French colonialists, and it wasn't really an original part of the early Voodoo religions. That it evolved as the fear and mystery of what these religions were about were how they were interpreted by others. However, there were always figures that were manipulated. It's somewhat like a Ouija board construction. And so figures are important. But the whole idea of sticking needles in figures was a later development. But the idea captures our imagination that you could somehow symbolically express your anger or your hostility towards a person. I think in our world, we don't want to really harm anyone, but that's the idea with the voodoo doll, is that you could, without really hurting them, be expressing some of these feelings. But that actual part of sticking needles in something was not an early part of the religion, as I understand it.
Okay. Well, as we begin to wind down here, I want to return to the idea of healing. I think that's such a compelling one. And the idea that art making, I guess, generally is part of a healing process. And I'm reminded of Jung, who went through, and you can probably talk about this in greater detail than I can, who went through a very turbulent period psychologically. Some people felt he actually had a psychotic episode of some sort, but he was very close to his unconscious. And he kind of played with building little dams and rocks and all, and this was part of his healing. Maybe you can talk about that a little bit.
Well, I think just the healing aspect of doll making is the most important part to me, that I find art in all of its forms a way to feel, experience wholeness, or at least the path towards wholeness. And so my understanding that Jung also had a few of these little mannequin dolls.
Really? Yeah.
That he hid up in some rafters and then uncovered later on. And that actually I think of Carl Jung as one of the people who made this whole importance of art so available to us, that his great journals were filled with wonderful drawings and that he inspired his clients and others to use art and to explore art as a way to a path to the unconscious. And so this is one of the heroes in the expressive arts world, part of the lineage going back to a variety of shamans and wood carvers and, you know, figure makers and dancers and musicians. And I mean, we can look at the relationship between art and healing historically,
yeah,
all the way,
yeah,
back. But yes, I think healing is important. And one reason it's even more important now is our lives have taken us far away from art.
Mm-hmm.
I say it myself to my friends that, oh my gosh, I wish I had more time to do this or to work on some art and so forth. We're all very busy, and it's one of the first things to fall off our list. So
I'm feeling guilty now because,
yes,
when I took up podcasting, I stopped studying the piano.
Uh-oh. But this is what I would say is most important, is that we remember to put this back on our list.
Yeah.
That we make creativity a part of our life, whether it's, you know, the way you cook or the way you prepare your home for someone, or the way in which you also take time out to listen to music or go to a play with someone, or that we go to that imaginal world as frequently as we can make time for.
That is a great place for us to wrap it up, Dr. Jerry Olson. Thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
And thank you so much. It's so much fun to be with you.
I'm very pleased to finally have had the opportunity to share my longtime friend and colleague, Jerry Olson, with you. She's a very remarkable lady. She tends to be very modest and self-deprecating, but she's a brilliant and inspiring teacher. And it's too bad that this presentation is restricted to audio, because her work is truly three-dimensional. If you'll go to the show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com, you'll find a link to some photos of dolls that Jerry's students have made, as well as a link to a fine paper that she published on this subject. Somewhere toward the end of our conversation, I realized that I have a number of dolls that I haven't really identified as such, but I have them nonetheless. And even where I sit right now in front of my computer, I see several of my dolls in this room. I have a treasured, fuzzy, stuffed animal of a American bald eagle. It's actually sitting on top of my shrink wrap radio microphone flag, which is on top of my computer printer. And this cute little bald eagle stands about 6 or 7 inches tall. And it's special to me because it was given to me by my good friend from New Hampshire, Dwight Webb, who you may recall me interviewing on The Soul of Counseling. And he gave it to me probably 20 years or more ago. And I haven't seen him for 4 or 5 years, but as synchronicity would have it, I did in fact see him just yesterday, as he did a one-night stopover in San Francisco on his way back to New Hampshire from Taiwan, where he gave a number of presentations about his book, which, by the way, has been translated into Chinese. And he's such a special friend that my soul is lifted, soaring like the eagle he gave me, just by the time we were able to spend together yesterday. And on the little pedestal where the printer rests are two little doll-like figures. One is the horse-faced Jar Jar Binks from one of the later Star Wars films, or several of them. And a lot of people didn't like that character, but he really tickles my funny bone. I think I keep him around to remind me of my own lighter side. And he's flanked by a little rubber figure of a sitting Buddha who is holding a latte in one hand and a cell phone in the other. Maybe you've seen this one somewhere. It's around quite a bit. And again, to me, this is a very playful figure, and he perfectly captures something about me, I think, interested in the spiritual dimension and being totally present on the one hand and totally immersed in contemporary culture and technology on the other. I embrace my Buddha nature as well as my Starbucks coffees and my iPhone. Then, on a nearby shelf, I have a ceramic figure known as the Five Sun Buddha. I don't have five sons, but I do have three sons and a daughter. The Five Sun Buddha was another gift from a special friend many years ago who recognized and celebrated with me my love for my children. And this was when my twins were toddlers, and as with the Five Sun Buddha, they would climb all over me. So keeping this smiling Buddha with the kids crawling on him close at hand is also good for my soul. I also have a little puppet I made years ago, probably inspired either directly or indirectly by Jerry Olson. I did a weekend retreat years ago in a section of Myth, Dream, and Symbol that I was teaching, and we all made paper mache puppets. Mine turned out to be a little king with a crown who I named King David. I always feel so uncreative and untalented whenever I lead students in one of these sorts of exercises, but then I end up falling in love with what I've created. I've also got a lovely Raggedy Ann doll that I don't remember how it came into my life, but my wife and I use it to play practical jokes on each other from time to time, putting it in unlikely and unexpected places, sometimes as a gentle nag to do some chore or another. And in my office at the university, I have a really neat stuffed animal gorilla, which was another gift from another special friend who knew of my fascination with our simian cousins. Well, enough about me and my dolls. Perhaps you have some dolls that have played an important role in your life, or some that you haven't fully recognized as dolls.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
As I've mentioned before, we've decided to continue with the Shrink Wrap Radio live shows on Blog Talk Radio, but to do so less frequently. So I'm giving you lots of advance notice. Our next live show will be on Sunday morning, February 3rd at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, returning to the original time slot. My co-host, Jerry Trumbull, and I are hoping you'll join us then at www.blogtalkradio.com/shrinkwrapradio. There are several ways you can lend your energy to Shrink Wrap Radio. One is to put yourself on our Frapper map. If you aren't already there, you'll find a link on our website. Another is to post a review on iTunes if you haven't done so already. And yet another is to click on the Dig button on our show site. And finally, you can post comments on any given show on our site. We've been getting some wonderful activity in the comments area. Be sure to see what others have been writing and to add your own reactions. Remember, the sponsors for this show are Podshow and GoDaddy. You can get yourself a domain name at a 10% discount by using the code SHRINK3 at checkout from GoDaddy.com.
Hi there. You're on the couch. You're on a wild goose chase. You're on to bigger and better things. You're on to something with Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks, Powder Skier, for that transition. I'm hoping others of you will send in some nice transitions like that. In the meantime, let's check out some of our recent emails. First, we hear from Alana, whose email is quite relevant to today's show on doll work. She had previously written about using sand play in her teaching as an artist, and I asked her to share more about her work. And here's Alana's reply. She wrote, "Thank you for asking about how I use sand play. I'm afraid it's difficult to explain briefly. Don't feel obliged to read it all, but I've tried to contextualize it a little bit below. The sand tray is a pivotal part of the senior visual art program. Students are encouraged to use the tray intuitively and then tell the story of the physical image in a visual journal. They then work with the symbols, developing further drawn and sometimes digital images, and eventually incorporate an interpretation of the image." You know, Alana, that's interesting because Jerry was talking about having her students keep a visual journal as part of the journal-keeping exercise in Myth, Dream, and Symbol. Now back to Alana's email. She goes on to say, "The idea follows from the precept that art making is about facilitating personal discovery. Much of the art program is based on the idea that an image or symbol carries an entire thought or philosophy in one hit. It does not involve a linear progression as written language does, and thereby, as Jung himself said, image and meaning are identical. There is no simplification, but rather an ongoing interrogation of the images, much as you would when deconstructing a dream. In effect, students work from the inside out, thereby making their artworks a true reflection or embodiment of their inner life and personal aesthetic, gradually coming to understand the necessity of process in the creative endeavor." I couldn't have said that any better myself. And I've taken the liberty, by the way, Alana, of forwarding this email to Jerry because I thought she would enjoy it as well. Now, Alana goes on. She's describing what I think is a secondary level, like what we would call a high school art program in a high school setting in the UK. She goes on to say, "The senior program is built around the concept of the labyrinth, and we build our own, usually about 15 meters across, on the beach at the first full moon of the school year." And she attached an image of one that they made in 2004. She says, "The grade 11 students walk it as the moon rises. In the units of work that follow, we use metaphors such as alchemy and emergence as starting points for the various concepts and tasks. And the entire art course acts, in a sense, as a rite of passage for the girls." It's an all-girls school. "With a strong focus on them unfolding a personal philosophy through the images and visual language that emerges. With so few opportunities in our current education system for true engagement beyond, quotes, information in, information out, close quote, and vocational and grade-driven outcomes at the forefront, I've found that given the opportunity to delve deep, students respond in the most surprising ways. We've had tears around the sand tray, true expressions of joy and awe upon emerging from the labyrinth, hours of image and dream sharing, discoveries of authentic ways of learning, anger, even amazement, but always the opening of doors between teacher and student as a result of the opportunity to talk soul to soul. This is why I love Shrink Wrap Radio, Jung, June Singer, the work of Leonard Schlain. These things feed me and keep me connected to what I value, making it possible to remain open-hearted and open-minded for my students. Have you thought of approaching Leonard Schlain, author of The Alphabet and the Goddess and Art and Physics, to talk on Shrink Wrap Radio? Sorry to have rambled, but given the opportunity to write about what I love, well, as you can see, Alana. Thank you so much for sending that email and for suggesting Leonard Schlain. I had not thought of him. I've put him down on my to-do list, and I really understand what you're talking about, the gratification of that kind of teaching. That's the sort of teaching that I was able to enjoy in my teaching career and that Jerry Olson was trying to get across in our conversation, and you've gotten it across very well in this note here, Alana. Your students are privileged to have the exposure that you're giving them, and you're lucky to be working in a school system where you're allowed to do that kind of work. Next, we hear from Susan, who writes, commenting on our last Shrink Wrap Radio Live podcast with Dr. Doug Davis. In part, her email says, "Dr. Dave, I really enjoyed the discussion with Doug Davis. Indeed, I got off my behind and ordered Dragon," she's referring to Dragon Naturally Speaking, which we discussed, "and hope it will work for me. And I went back to reading the amazing Mimex article. Fascinating story of trying to get a theme for post-war scientists to work on. Also referenced to the vocoder work deployed at the 1939 World Fair is a great event in synthetic voice and voice recognition that now pervades my life. Brings back tales told by my mother of the trip she took with friends to the fair also." I'm skipping over some parts. Then she says, "I hope this note gives you some feedback on topics and discussion methods for Shrink Wrap Radio Live, which is great to listen to. I just wanted you to know that talking about the past is still worthy and sure dredged up some of my past for me to revisit and learn from and connect to my current world. Thanks, Susan." And Susan, thank you so much for that feedback. It means a lot to both me and to Jerry, and encourages us to keep up our work there, but maybe on a less frequent basis. Then I heard from my good friend and listener, Paul, in Ireland, who dropped a quick note of suggestion. He says, "Hi, Dave. Just listening to Live number 4, Jack Panksepp would be an excellent guest. I've come across a lot of work in relation to neuropsychoanalysis. He is a very distinguished researcher. Best regards, Paul." And Paul, I took that cue, as you know, because I CC'd you, and immediately sent off an invitation to him. However, I haven't heard back from him yet. And I think I'll read just one more email for today. This one reads, it's a long one, so this will be the last one. "Hi, Dr. Dave. Greetings from England. I'm a high school science teacher. I've been listening to your show for about a year, and I think it's really fascinating." Thanks, that's high praise coming from a science teacher. He goes on, "I initially discovered it when I searched for stuff on Jung on iTunes, and Shrink Wrap Radio came up. From the show titles, it was quickly apparent that you cover an enormous range of topics, and after listening to a couple of shows, I was hooked. I've listened to most of them now, but my favorite one was with Brother Bernard. He seems such a wise man with an extraordinarily open attitude to life. Of course, lots of your guests are inspiring and interesting, but the show with Brother Bernard really spoke to me, maybe because I had a great uncle who was a monk and also radiated the same sense of wisdom, serenity, and openness. It was good to hear Brother Bernard's voice again on the recent show when he left the message saying hello." Well, Richard, I hope it's okay with you. I forwarded this email to Brother Bernard. I haven't heard back, but hopefully he got it, because I thought he would really appreciate hearing the tribute that you've given him. Now back to Richard's email. He says, "I've been listening with a lot of pleasure to Shrink Wrap Live. Number 2 was especially good. You and Jerry seemed on top form. It's interesting to hear you talking and exploring issues around AI in such depth. I thought, though, that everyone seemed tired and not so with it on number 5. The news that you're cutting down on the frequency of Live was not a surprise, but if you want my opinion, Shrink Wrap Radio Live is an excellent idea, although it's not really possible for me to tune in live. I download it later. Some other comments on the show. I like the extended length of recent shows compared to earlier ones. They allow the discussions to go into more depth." Well, that's good feedback. I appreciate getting that feedback because, I don't know, in the early days when the shows were shorter, they were running 20 to 30 minutes, it seemed like I had a much larger listenership. I think my listenership now is maybe, you know, maybe 2/3 to half the size that it was then, but maybe more dedicated. So, but sometimes I wonder, you know, geez, should I make the whole thing shorter to have more listeners or not? I suppose I could cut out the reading of the email and the other kinds of announcements that I make and just sort of make it more to the point, as I do with Wise Counsel. But then that would rob some of the pleasure for me. These other elements for me make Shrink Wrap Radio distinctive and special, and I hope go towards building a community. I hope that you agree with me on that point. But if you think it would be better, just sort of straight, you know, without a lot of fal de ra, you know, and more like in the mode of wise counsel where I don't make much of comment and so on, let me know. I'd be interested to hear about that. Richard goes on to say, occasionally you read out comments from people registering mild displeasure about some of the more way out guests. I think they're fine. It's the broad range of guests that help keep the show so exciting. After all, your other podcast, Wise Counsel, is a lot more straight. That's very true. And there is that difference, and it's on purpose, just as you point out. He goes on to say, I was surprised to enjoy your roaming interviews at the Dream Conference, the New Media Expo, and so on. I was reluctant to give these a chance at first, but I found that I liked the whole nature of them. They reveal a different side of you. The New Media Expo show did not appeal to me at all, but I really enjoyed it, perhaps because you and your guests were also clearly enjoying themselves. I've been taking classes recently on Freud and Jung. They're both fascinating, so it would be good if you could have some more shows featuring themes related to these two great thinkers. Indeed, I will. He goes on, occasionally the adverts at the start of the show are really inappropriate. The Help Us Suck Less one was pathetic. Do you have any influence on what adverts they insert? It would be nice if they could keep them tasteful and unobtrusive. Having said that, I used to like the Roses Are Red GoDaddy one that used to be on. Okay, let me respond to that right here. I totally agree with you. I hated the Help Us Suck Less insert. I don't have any influence on what those inserts are. I think a lot of us podcasters with PodShow were unhappy with the Help Us Suck Less promotion, and fortunately, I think they got the message, and that has not been repeated. And I think the inserts recently have been very brief and tasteful. I have in the past complained that sometimes they weren't tasteful. They didn't fit with the nature of my particular show. I am grateful to PodShow. They, you know, they're hosting these shows. They do pay me a small amount of money for having these ads, and it kind of helps pay for things like microphones and software and going to the PodShow Expo and so on. So that's why I'm doing it, and we try to keep it unobtrusive. And then to finish up on Richard's email, he says, finally, the music you use is fine, especially at the start and end of the show. He says, I'm glad you got rid of the PodSafe music tracks you used to play. But do you think perhaps the Eastern theme track you sometimes play as a link in the middle of the show goes on a bit? I find I skip through it. Well, yes, it is long. You're right. And it's kind of an ego thing because I wrote the words. And I really liked the melody, and it was kind of the melody was kind of done to my specs. And you know, I could shorten it up, and probably I should do that. This is just kind of my ego trip, and I don't need to play the whole thing. I could fade it out much sooner. So maybe that's what I'll do in the future, or at least some of the time. So Richard wraps up. Anyway, that's all. Keep up the good work, and thanks for all the fantastic shows. And that's Richard, high school science teacher in the UK. And Richard, I really appreciate hearing from you. So that'll wrap it up for our emails today. And for those of you who haven't written or who are ready to write again, please do so. You can send it to shrink at shrinkwrapradio. And you can also leave comments about the individual shows in the comments area on the site. Can leave voicemails on Skype. My name there is ShrinkPod, and you can leave voice messages on my Chingo. And also, we have a phone voicemail at 206-337-0622. Thanks again to my friend Dr. Jerry Olson for sharing her work on dolls. My next guest will be Dr. Max Schupbach. Building on the earlier interview with Julie Diamond on process work, Dr. Schupbach will be teaching us about the application of process work known as world work. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.